Welcome back to Accelerando. My name is Paula Tuttle, and today we put the spotlight on the Theorbo. You're actually hearing the Theorbo played by Scott Pauley with Chatham Baroque right now. And I'm here to tell you that if you want to see and hear a live Theorbo this week, you can go to Pittsburgh Opera's production of Handel's Ariodante. It's true that Chatham Baroque leaders are joining the Pittsburgh Opera Orchestra this week. Andrew Fouts will be acting as concertmaster, Patricia Halvorsen plays the gamba, and Scott Pauley plays the Theorbo. As a music student, I inevitably came across the Theorbo in history or maybe theory classes. But my first interaction with one was when we did Julius Caesar at the Pittsburgh Opera in 2004. And in the last 10 years or so, the Pittsburgh-based early Renaissance group, Chatham Baroque, has been featured in Baroque operas like the one we're doing this month. The Theorbo reads a figured bass line, and we can ask Scott, who's joining us today, about why and how the Theorbo reads this unusual and somewhat exclusive notation. So the longer strings, they are an octave below the shorter strings.
Yes.
Is it a scale?
Yeah, it's just an open diatonic scale. Yeah, so starting all the way at the bottom, it's just a scale from low G, like the G below the bottom line of bass clef. So right now it's tuned to all natural notes so that there's no F sharp, but I could change that to an F sharp, but in the lower octave, but then you're kind of stuck with that note, you know, for the whole piece. So in an opera, like we're doing now, you have to kind of take stock of like all the keys, and Handel, of course, goes into almost every key that was used at that time. So I find it's better just to have them all natural, and then if I need a sharper flat, I go up the octave.
Is that something that you have to decide as a performer?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, you sort of get used to, as a Theorbo player, like jumping up and down octaves a lot. Sometimes you can use the lower octave very effectively, especially like in a recitative, or like if you want to have a dramatic moment, you know, you can really thump on a low bass note.
So there's no fingerboard on these low notes.
That's
only
right.
A fingerboard on the regular lute. It's like a lute with an extension.
Exactly. They took just what was a normal lute and extended its string length by quite a bit and made the body large. And then they added this whole octave of bass strings that are just one octave tuned to a scale. People often ask me, like after a concert, why aren't you playing those strings? They don't see my left hand fingering them because there's no neck, no fingerboard for those strings, but I'm actually always playing them with my right thumb. And so I think what attracted me to this instrument was I started as a guitarist. So it has that aspect of guitar, and it's actually very similar tuning to a guitar. I also played the double bass and the electric bass as a kid, so it was like a bass and guitar rolled into one.
Exactly.
So it's got a lot of features that I like, you know, as a musician. I like being a bass player. I also like being a guitarist. I also like improvising. I played a little jazz as a younger person. A lot of what I do is improvisational and in the moment, you know, you have to decide what to play.
Right. As a theorbist, you're given a figured bass.
Exactly. So, for example, a bass note that has nothing written above it is usually implied that it is a root position chord, or what we call 5-3. And those are the intervals above the bass note. So if this is my bass note, C, there's the 5, there's a 3, there's a 1. So I can play a fuller chord, but as long as the bass is still in the bottom, that's just a root position chord. If I want to take it to this first inversion, and that would look like a 6 above, or a 6-3 above, it's those notes starting on the third of the chord. I could also start down here. If it's second inversion, be like that.
So you play the lute as well, and you play it with Chatham Baroque, or is that just something you do elsewhere?
I do some with Chatham Baroque, especially if we do, say, an earlier program of like Elizabethan music, or if we stretch back into the 16th century before the theorbo was really invented. It was invented right around that time, around 1600. If we go a little earlier, then yeah, for sure, I will play the lute or other instruments like the vihuela, the Spanish lute. I also have some solo lutes that are later, like from the 18th century, that are good for like Bach and his contemporary Weiss. So, but again, there aren't as many opportunities to play that instrument in concert, so I tend to do a little more of that on my own. Also with my wife, Pascal Baudin, who's a singer, so we do some things together with the lutes and the other instruments.
Does anybody ever write solo works for the theorbo?
Like nowadays? There are a few, yes, and some of them are quite nice. There's a guy in New York, who's actually a Ukrainian-American lute/theorbo player who writes some beautiful things, and Roman Tarovsky is his name. Several others as well. Stephen Goss, Scott Fields.
So I was looking on Wikipedia of, you know, on the theorbo, because it is really an interesting page, and there's a list of players, and we have to add you to it.
Yeah. I guess I have not been very good about putting myself out there on Wikipedia. Yeah, but yeah, that would be good.
I know the name Paul Odette because his name was on a door at Eastman. I don't remember ever running into him.
He's one of the best. I mean, he's fantastic lute player, and he plays theorbo, of course. And he's one of the directors of the Boston Early Music Festival, along with Stephen Stubbs. He's fantastic. Mm-hmm. My own teacher, Nigel North, I worked with him in London for several years in the early 90s and that was at the Guildhall School in London. And that was before he himself came to the States to take a position at Indiana University in Bloomington.
I know that the first time I saw a theorbo there, you weren't available, but you were already in town. And this was around 2004, I think, that they did Julius Caesar.
Right.
And I didn't even know what a theorbo was. I probably came across it in music history somewhere, but I had no idea that it was this giant. It's like the giraffe in the zoo.
It is, yeah. I mean, it always elicits, you know, kind of gasps from the audience if people haven't seen it. It's funny looking. It's like a lute with a giraffe's neck stuck on it, or a garden rake. You know, it's like 6 feet tall and has the pear shape, like if you took a pear and sliced it in half, that's kind of the shape of the body. It has a carved rosette figure on top. Most lutes have just one rosette that often looks a little bit like a carved stained glass window, but this one has three, kind of a triangular shaped rosette that was common for the larger lutes. And it's just a sound hole, but it's just highly decorated. But that is all carved right into the top, which is incredible. Like, I don't know how they do that. My maker, Klaus Jacobson, in London, is so talented.
So you have it fold because the lute is so long, and you have the two peg boxes, and it makes sense, you know?
Right.
Just fold it down, and somebody made a case for you.
Yes. When I first got the instrument in the 90s, it was not foldable. Things that have made air travel so much more difficult and expensive, it should become less practical to travel with a really long case, and sometimes they won't guarantee that it'll even get there if you check the bag. I had a good flight case. I flew for probably 20 years with this case, and then one time, just bad luck, it was damaged badly. To the airline's credit, they took care of the cost of repairing it, but I had to send it back to London. And then we decided at that time to fit the instrument with a folding neck, so it now fits in a case that's even smaller than a cello case, and it's quite manageable. So I can take it on board. I prefer, if I can, to buy a seat, because it's not always guaranteed that you get an overhead bin these days, unless you have very early boarding.
I started taking my electric cello with me when I was traveling, just because it would get in the overhead bin.
Right.
And then you'd buy the early bird arrival. You get on earlier with Southwest,
because
they can't kick you off if you find a spot for it.
Yeah, that's right.
So I feel your pain there.
Yeah, so anyway, I'm happy with the folding neck. It's a lot better for travel, even in the car. Like, it doesn't take, like, we used to have to go on long trips with the Theorbo sticking all the way up into the, you know, passenger driver seat area. Like, in our, you know, you'd have to stick your elbow on top and drive the car kind of awkwardly.
And it doesn't really affect the way it plays.
No, it's actually, strangely, like, I think this instrument, since it was damaged, actually sounds its best than it ever has. It was very scary at the time, but everything's good now.
So you're mainly a Theorbist more than anything else. When you're playing with Chatham Baroque, that is the instrument of choice.
Yeah, the Theorbo is kind of an unusual beast. It's a type of a lute. So a lute is a pluck string instrument that came to Europe via the Eastern world, kind of from Turkey all the way around to Morocco. The Arabic oud was its ancestor.
So where's the word Theorbo come from?
Well, it's a thorny question. It comes from the Italian word Theorba, which was what they called it in 17th century Italy. But its original name in Italy was called the chitarrone. And chitarrone meant a large kithara, or like Greek lyre, sort of a stringed instrument, almost like a little small handheld harp. And you see those, you know, in Greek art. Nobody really knows exactly what they sounded like, but there was a lot written about Greek lyres and music theory. And anyway, to make a long story short, the Theorbo, or Theorba, or chitarrone, came because the Italians wanted to recreate this ancient Greek form of music and drama together. So the earliest operas by Monteverdi, which we've done a couple together, were kind of this attempt to put the words above music. So like after the 16th century, where you think of Palestrina and all these different layers of polyphony and words not being spoken at the same time, different lines having independence, there was this like giant shift to just a bass line and just a voice together, and putting the text above everything else, putting the words above music. And that's kind of how the Theorbo was born, to kind of try to recreate that.
That's amazing.
It
goes
drama.
Yeah, going back to Greek drama, I can hear it in the Theorbo now that you mention it. Those really low notes. That is really so cool.
So chitarrone, the large kithara, you know, for some reason they ended up changing the name. I think around the 1620s, it became more commonly known as Theorba. Nobody knows exactly where that word comes from. I've heard different stories from friends and Italian people I know. And some people think it might have been a dialect for two heads, like Theorbes. And there are two peg boxes, one for the short fretted strings and one for the longer bass strings. So that seems like a plausible explanation.
Yeah, especially since a lot of times they will carve a head on the scroll.
Exactly.
So have you ever seen a Theorbo with carvings that are pretty ornate as heads?
I haven't seen that exactly, more like a lot of viola da gambas and older, you know, members of that instrument family have beautiful heads that are carved at the top of the peg box. But yeah, in the Theorbo, it's just usually kind of a nice, simple peg box. But anyway, I think the idea of a head in the peg box makes sense to me. And then that became, you know, the Theorbo branched out from Italy into France and then England and all over Europe and even into the New World. There were Theorbos and other long-necked lutes. So there's a cousin, also very long-necked lute called the arch lute, and it's very similar, just a little different tuning. And that made its way all the way to places like Mexico City and Peru, where there was, you know, the earliest opera houses, so their records of players of these long-necked instruments in those places, which I think is really fascinating.
So was the predecessor the bass lute?
Yeah, basically that's right. I think they were searching for the ideal instrument to accompany this new kind of music, drama in music. The earliest operas were called drama per musica, like drama in music. So like Peri, Caccini, Monteverdi, all of those guys were searching for this new style. I think hand in hand with that was trying to find the right instrument. There's kind of like a controversy about who really invented the theorbo. Two different players and composers claim it. One was Capsperger and the other was Piccinini. And they're both early 17th century Italians who wrote books of theorbo solo music. And each one claims to have been the inventor. So who knows?
Like the inventor of the telephone. You know, it was going to happen anyways. It was like time for a theorbo to emerge.
Yeah.
And two people thought of it at the same time.
And I think the addition of the bass notes just gave that extra bit of actually sound. I mean, the lute is even softer than the theorbo, and that theorbo was considerably louder and more resonant than its predecessor, the lute. So adding those long bass notes, I think, was key to also taking the theorbo out of like a really small chamber setting into a slightly larger theatrical setting. So the first theaters were super small. They were done in, like, the first Monteverdi opera was done like in a small room in a palazzo. Soon after that, there were opera houses built. But if you go back to some of those earliest opera houses, they're really tiny, you know, comparatively, like few hundred seats as opposed to a few thousand. So like it could be heard quite well in a setting like that.
You came to Pittsburgh to join Chatham Baroque, and I'm trying to remember the year because, funny thing, we were neighbors.
Yes.
I watched you moving in. That was the craziest thing. And so I'm going to guess it was 1996.
Exactly right.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So yep. 1996, you joined Chatham Baroque, and it's changed since then, right?
That's right, yes. When I came in 1996, the group had been going for several years. It started in 1991, around that time, with founding members Patricia Halverson, who's still with us and is our only remaining founding member, along with Emily Davidson, who sadly passed away in 2003. And at that time, we also had, well, Patty and myself. So, and the same year that I joined was Julie Andrzejewski. So she came on violin as well. So the group before that had a recorder and violin, as well as a harpsichord and gamba. So I just kind of stumbled on this newsletter. I had been living in London and was expecting our first child and was kind of looking for ways to get back to the States to be a little closer to family. And I saw this notice for Chatham Baroque is looking for a harpsichordist. And I'm like, well, maybe they would consider a theorbo player, because we do the same kind of duties. We play the figured bass, we play the continuo part. I mean, it's a different thing, of course, and some things are better suited for theorbo, others are better suited for harpsichord. But anyway, I called up my old friend from Stanford, where I had gone to grad school, and Patty Halverson had gone there as well. We knew each other, we had done a few concerts together. I said, hey, have you filled up this harpsichordist position? And she's like, not yet, we have a few candidates, but I think nothing was quite clicking. So I came out to Pittsburgh from London, like just 2 weeks before my daughter was to be born. And I came on a beautiful April weekend. It was like, you know, all the flowers were blooming, the trees were in bloom, the tulips were out. And I was like, wow, this is awesome. Pittsburgh has great weather.
Yeah, Pittsburgh has a good week in April.
No, I mean, I love the city. I could tell, you know, I knew the weather wasn't going to be spectacular, but I loved the city. I loved the vibe. And I loved that these guys had started this group and really had something going. So, you know, I made the move and have been here ever since.
Right. But we were only neighbors for a year.
Right. Yeah.
But I remember that. And then I actually moved into that building, but not your apartment.
Oh, yeah.
And it was a great building because it had all these wood floors and everything.
Right.
I just loved it for the cello. So the Chatham Baroque is basically the three of you, but you very often expand to have a harpsichordist.
Yes.
Do you have a regular harpsichordist?
Well, lately we've been working more and more with Justin Wallace, who's also based here in Pittsburgh and has really gone to lengths to become a great harpsichordist and also a harpsichord kind of restorationist. He's taken some instruments that were in need of some help and brought them back to life just so beautifully. And so that's really a passion of his. He's also a church organist. He's a composer. So he lives like a multifaceted life as a musician, but he's playing more and more with us. We also have some other regulars we play with. Andrew Appel from Four Nations Ensemble in New York. Adam Pearl, who is a wonderful player from Baltimore area, teaches at Peabody. Oh, there are a few others we use as well who are all, they're all awesome. We have a nice bit of choice there in the harpsichord department. And sometimes organ we'll use as well. So like our colleague Alan Lewis at Calvary has a beautiful chamber organ and we play with him often there. And he's the one who often leads these Messiah performances or Passions in the Easter Lent season. The organ I actually like myself because it's a nice complement to the theorbo. It's more sustaining, and I think the theorbo plucked sound with the organ is one of my favorites. So I love that.
Yeah, because the harpsichord plucks also.
Yeah, sometimes it's hard to distinguish kind of between the two, unless you really, like, especially in a recording, you have to be careful to position yourselves in a way that each one is heard distinctly.
So when you read music as a theorbist, you're reading a figured bass, and I like to say you're pluck by number.
Right, that's right.
And some of us studied that in college, but there have been musicians that I know are really established musicians, and they'll say, what are those numbers? And I'm like, you studied that in school, but we forget.
Yeah.
So let's have a little refresher. What's it like to read a figured bass? What's it look like? And
so basically we have the bass line, and in a lot of music the figures are numbers to tell you which chord to play with that bass line. Sometimes they're included and sometimes they're not. So often they're included sparsely, like for example in the Handel opera we're doing right now, Ariodante. There, you know, every so often these figures appear and it's like, well, why did you decide to put those in and not these others? Because, you know, it just doesn't always make sense to me. But anyway, the technique is not that different from, say, like a jazz fake book where you have chord symbols. I mean, these numbers are just telling you what chord to play. So if you remember what the first opera was we did with Pittsburgh, was it a Monteverdi or?
I might not have played it because usually Kathy Malucci is alone joining Patty on the bass line.
Right.
But it's great playing with you guys because now we're called like a bass line section. I love that term.
Yeah.
So in this opera, we have two cellos, Kathy Malucci and myself, Jeff Mangone on bass, Patty Halverson. She's kind of the leader of the bass line group, would you say?
Yeah. I mean, she's playing most of the recitatives, right? And for sure. But yeah, it's great. It's great for us to come in and play with you guys. I mean, because as a small chamber ensemble, it's a hard thing for us to like put on a full opera.
You know, well, you did.
It takes resources. I mean, well, we did it with really with Quantum Theater's resources for Adaspe, but we did have a great time with that project. But we're always happy to join Pittsburgh Opera because, I mean, Anthony is such a great conductor. He knows this rep really well. There's always a nice class of singers who are really fun to work with. And it's fun to watch some of them really take to this repertoire. You know, like I think a lot of them have sung more like Verdi, Puccini and other mainstream 19th century opera rep. And maybe they came into doing a Handel opera for the first time. You know, maybe they're a little unsure if this is really their cup of tea, but then by the end they're really doing it and they're really committed and they're doing the ornaments and they're doing their phrasing in a different sort of way. So I think there's a lot of value that they gain from doing this rep, as well as, you know, and they go in the other direction as well with that program. They go into the contemporary rep. They get so much good experience. And we've seen so many singers come through who we've worked with and then later on they're like, wow, they're singing all over the place.
When we do these Baroque operas, we always play it in a smaller venue.
During COVID, we did one at the opera.
I think we did Julius Caesar in the Byam, the same place that you did Idaspe. It seems pretty appropriate for a Baroque opera, maybe a little bit big.
There was one over at Carnegie Mellon as well, and I can't remember. That was a while, going back a while. It might have been either a Monteverdi or a Cavalli opera. So we've done, I know, at least two Monteverdis, a Cavalli, and then maybe, I don't know, five or five or more Handels by now. So it's been a great way for us to learn that repertoire, because we're normally doing chamber music, and so it's a real privilege for us to like be able to do these full productions of opera with.
It seems like these Handel operas, they aren't done that much, and it might be because they don't have a theorbo, you know, to do it. And it really is, if you're going to get the sound, you have to have a theorbo in a Handel opera.
It's funny. I mean, I think there were either theorbos or archlutes in most Handel operas up to a point, and it's not totally clear like when that disappeared in London, but there were players into the probably 1730s. This is one of his latest operas, isn't it? 1735. You know, he liked that sound, but he himself was a harpsichordist, keyboard player, organist, and probably played all the instruments as well, because he wrote so well for them. But I can imagine Handel sitting, you know, at the keyboard conducting these operas. And I think, going back to your figure bass question, maybe part of the reason there weren't so many figures in his operas is that he, you know, he knew the piece, he wrote it. So like he's
just wrote it out.
He didn't need to write all the figures in, because he just knew the music.
Oh, you're saying he was reading off the bass he would figure it in his head. Yeah,
exactly. Or he might have been playing from a full score but not had figures. He just could see the whole score and hear the whole score without needing to mark figures in.
Did you have to mark your figures in?
I did, yeah.
So most of them are missing from the score.
Most of them are missing, yeah. And it's a big job to do a whole opera. It takes me about 4 or 5 days of steady work to do a whole full-length opera, because you just have to go through every piece really carefully, look at it, you know, all the voices above, and you also have to decide like how often you're gonna change chords, or is it just like a quick change that doesn't merit a full, you know, change of harmony. So it takes some thought. You have to play through things, and then even then I find after the first rehearsal I'm like, yeah, I think I need to go back and change something.
Right, you're almost composing. I mean, it's not like doing bowings where you're just deciding what the articulation is, because your articulation is always pluck, pluck, pluck.
Right.
You know? But you are deciding on the harmony. Has the maestro ever complained about your choice?
Yeah. Sometimes, yeah, we do have lively discussions about, you know, should this be a root position chord, or should it be a 6 or a 6-5, or, you know, different flavors of chords. And also with the harpsichordist Mark Trofka, we talk, you know, every rehearsal we're talking about, what do you like here? Sometimes it's not clear even if it should be major or minor. Like there's a choice. Like if it's not in the part above, you have to decide, or you decide to leave it out. All sorts of little choices along the way.
That's crazy. I just can't imagine it, you know, because he never says anything in our rehearsals about the harmony.
Mm-hmm.
But you had a rehearsal last night that was full tech with 4 hours, and you're doing that again tonight.
Right.
And did you have any rehearsals with the group of you with Anthony?
Yeah,
We
had one early rehearsal with Mark and Anthony, just kind of going over exactly those things, the harmonies and the rest, especially the recitatives. Deciding who plays where in the recitative is another thing, like which color do you want to have associated with different characters. So like some characters we both play, like the king, the big rich bass voice, we tend to both play. Some of the lighter voices, like one or the other of us might play alone. So yeah, I think also like what affect he's going for, both the composer and the conductor, you know, he'll decide where he wants to deploy us.
So it's really important that you know the story.
Yes.
And you know what each aria is about.
Yep.
Because you're reflecting the sentiment
exactly
of the sentence.
Right. Especially so in the recitatives. I mean, the arias, you know, in Baroque opera, it's only like 4 lines of text that's repeated over and over. So you do have to get the sense of what they're saying in that aria. But even more important, I think, is in the recits, where like the story is really being told, and the arias are kind of more a reflection of what they just said in a generalized way. And they're also a vehicle to show off their beautiful voices and their beautiful singing and their ornamentation and all sorts of things like that.
Chatham Baroque does a lot of recordings. I know you guys have done a lot, and you even have your own label. So let's talk about a piece. Maybe there's something interesting we can find.
Yeah, well, I love this piece that we recorded a while ago now, but it's by a composer named Giovanni Girolamo Kapsberger. And his name sounds really German, at least the last part, Kapsberger, but his first names are Italian. And he was the son, apparently, of a German colonel, and he spent most of his life in Rome, and is one of the people who claims to have invented the theorbo. And he published 4 books of solo music for the theorbo, or chitarrone. And this piece that I'm going to talk about is called the colazione, and it's named after an instrument that came probably from Turkey or the Ottoman Empire, and was an instrument kind of like a little bass instrument, also probably with a long neck, but it only had either 2 or 3 strings, and it played in a different kind of style that would not be as familiar to like Western ears. So this piece kind of is an early example of exoticism in music. It has like parallel fifths, and it has parallel octaves. So it goes against like all the rules of voice leading and counterpoint that would have been in place at the time. And it really does sound exotic.
He's a rule breaker.
Yeah. So the colazione is written in a style of notation called tablature. And that's the same kind of tablature pretty much that even guitarists today sometimes play from. So instead of having 5 lines of notes, you have 6 lines that represent the top 6 strings of the instrument, and then the numbers that are written on each string tell you which fret you're playing on. So a 0 is an open, a 3, for example, is a 3rd fret, 2 would be 2nd fret, 1 1st fret, etc. And then the rhythms are written on top of that line, and they usually kind of shorthanded the rhythms with just the, you know, 1 quarter note, and you just keep playing that until you change to an 8th note here or something like that. So it's really like a shorthand, and you can write a lot of music in a really short space because printing and paper was at a premium in those days. So you know, a lot of people say, well, is it kind of a musically illiterate form of notation? I mean, I don't agree with that idea so much, because I think it was more like for expediency and saving space. And I think these same players also often played figured bass, which they would have had, you know, standard notation experience from that. But most lute music and theorbo music for solo is written in tablature, either this kind that Kapsberger used, which is Italian, and that's where the numbers are used. A similar kind of system called French tablature was used, where they used letter names instead of numbers.
It was great talking to you, Scott.
Thank you, Paula. It's been so much fun to talk to you.
Can't wait to be in the pit with you.
Yeah.
If you want to see Handel's Ariodante, conducted by Pittsburgh Opera's maestro Anthony Walker, at the Caput Theater, the theater is located at 111 9th Street, that's the corner of Fort Duquesne Boulevard, very close to the Convention Center and the 9th Street Bridge. There are 4 performances. The first one, opening night, Saturday, January 21st. Then the next week, Tuesday, January 24th. Friday, January 27th. And on Sunday, January 29th, it's a 2 p.m. matinee. The cast are all current Pittsburgh Opera resident artists. Jasmine Awalia in the title role of Ariodante. Emily Richter as Ginevra. Chawan Yuen Liu as Polonesso. Daniel O'Hearn sings Lurcanio. Evan Ladowski is the King of Scotland. And Julia Swan Laird sings Dalinda. Anthony Walker conducts the Pittsburgh Opera Orchestra, featuring Chatham Baroque, with Andrew Fouts, concertmaster and Baroque violin, Patricia Halverson playing the gamba, and Scott Pauly playing the theorbo. Come hear what's fab in the cultural district this week. It will delight your senses. Check the show notes at accelerandocast.com for more on the theorbo, Chatham Baroque, and Pittsburgh Opera. Have a great week, and maybe see you at the opera.